given everything you just said about your experience on many sides of this, you understand full well what is ahead of this team, the position this team is in, the fact that it's underperformed. How do you view your role and what you're attempting to do here now in the near term, at least?
Yeah, I think we're in a situation where you have an incredibly talented group of baseball players that haven't come together to perform at the level that we all expect and they expect. And I think you say, well, what can you do in this seat that's any different? I can't stand in the box. I can't go catch ground ball. I can't throw a pitch from the mound. This isn't a strategy problem. I think what it comes down to is the best thing we can do is recognize what keeps most people from performing is the burden they carry with them to work every day. And that burden is usually from caring too much and wanting to be great for a city, for a manager, for a team. And it comes from carrying the baggage of yesterday into today, how you've performed previously, and you show up in the box and you're carrying weight with you. And then you carry the weight of tomorrow and the next 45 days and what it means if you don't get it going in the way you want to get it going. And you carry that weight to the box and you carry it to the mound, and every pitch means more than it needs to be. Guys play their best when they play with joy. Guys play their best when they realize this isn't about strategy, it's about freedom. Guys play their best when you can cultivate that type of an environment. And there's no magic words I get to come in on day one and utter that completely flips the script. It's what we can do to help them feel 10 feet tall and bulletproof in a world where they get bullets shot at them all day long. In the very figurative sense here, making a mountain out of a molehill here. But these guys take it. And it means the world to them. So often what happens is you care too much. So when you get to these types of moments where a manager change occurs, you eliminate a measure of the burden in a way that nobody wants to, which is those guys are trying to come together for Mindy, to be great for Mindy, because they care about Mindy. And then when you get to the finality of this moment, then it's past. And then sometimes you see guys play with a greater measure of freedom, and that's the best thing I can do for this group. I think that's pretty much where it's at.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, June the 28th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And come join me on the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. It seems like it was just a couple of days ago because it was that we joined you for an emergency show, the firing of Carlos Mendoza. Mets lose 2 out of 3 of the Phillies. Actually, a good weekend series of baseball. I know that that doesn't give anybody a better feeling after the Mets lost a couple of tough one-run games over the weekend. But Mets lost 2 out of 3. The Andy Green era off to a 1-2 start. And we'll talk about Andy Green. I actually, after I had done the show, and I'm glad I did the show the way I did it, where I did it pre-press conferences and kind of give your reaction, and now post-press conference, I saw what Stearns had to say, I saw what Andy Green had to say, and then we could kind of move forward a little bit here and give a State of the Union about where the Mets are at, which, look, never going to be a fun show, even though it makes for a lot easier radio. I mean, I'll be straight, like, it was tough the last few weeks. It was like Groundhog Day, knowing that we're trying to see that flicker of hope that the Mets may be able to make this like 2024 type of run. We knew deep down, and we said it after we had our Memorial Day show, that it probably wasn't going to happen. But you hope, and then it was kind of Groundhog Day, and then you hit in that malaise, that baseball purgatory malaise when these seasons that aren't going well, start to hit that point. And then obviously the news about firing the manager and what comes next, not what you want to be talking about as a baseball fan here before the 4th of July. And let's also be honest, the Mets benefited a ton from the Knicks and what happened the last 2 months. They were able to kind of hide and figure things out. I think that the heat that's ratcheted up around the organization from the fans with Stearns at the ballpark, the media, embarrassing display by the media on Friday. I got to tell you, Mike Puma, I believe, asked the question, and he didn't correct me. I apologize. I'm pretty sure it was Puma. You know, should you have stepped down? I mean, you know what, Mike? Would you step down from your job? Even if the answer is, yeah, he deserves to step down, why would he if he's owed money? I mean, really, does anybody, in this day and age, everybody's working hard in a job where there's only one in 30 people. Why would he step down and give away the money? Let's just talk about it from a nuts and bolts sense. And just overall kind of goofy stuff came out of that press conference with Stearns, who right now is really kind of buttoned himself up. And then there was Andy Green, who I was actually quite impressed with. And the noise keeps getting louder and louder, and I think it's amped up now because the Knicks are finally in the back burner, the parade, the celebration. You probably watched 3 billion highlights of Game 4 by now. I know OG Anunoby was at the ballpark today throwing out a first pitch, so maybe that puts the cherry on top. Hey, listen, personally, I went to the city today. I went to go take a picture with the Larry O'Brien trophy at Tiffany's because I wanted to get a piece of history and be up close. So, look, I'm as guilty as anything, but anyway, you know, front and center now, and I think with the Yankees pretty much gearing themselves up for a postseason run, and the Mets now, a lot of controversy, you know, away we go here with the baseball landscape. So let's start with some reaction here on Andy Green, because I want to start there before I get to Stearns and a really critical, and you could see from the headline of the show, this is a really critical time in Mets history. And this is a critical point in Cohen's ownership that we're now nearly 6 years in. And it's amazing how quickly it's gone by that it's been 6 years of Steve Cohen ownership. It seems like yesterday he took over. But the thing about Andy Green is I went in to the press conference almost not expecting much, expecting a lot of platitudes and cliches, and I didn't know much about him. Obviously, he managed out in San Diego. He had a very brief cup of coffee, hot minute with the Mets in 2009. I don't remember him in 2009, and I was doing this kind of stuff in 2009. I don't remember. There was so much going on off the field in 2009. A guy that was up for a hot minute like Andy Green, you're not going to remember. Basically, a 4A guy with the Diamondbacks, been managing for a while, bench coach with the Cubs, been in the Mets front office, had running player development. But what I heard was probably, and I'm not downplaying this, or maybe I should say, maybe I'm not using some lionization here. I shouldn't say downplaying it. Wrong term. I was thinking of something else. I thought he was one of the more erudite baseball people I've heard on the podium in a long time. And I love Buck Showalter. Buck was a smart baseball guy, but Buck was also an old school entertainer. Buck knew how to keep the media at bay. Buck knew how to talk to the media. I mean, Terry Collins was kind of a grifter, in my opinion. He knew how to be folksy and aw shucks, but there was no meat and potatoes there. Mickey Callaway was in over his head. Luis Rojas, similar to Carlos Mendoza, was nondescript. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably what did Mendoza. And if you read Will Salmon's article over at The Athletic, I mean, Cohen doesn't want to be impulsive, and he doesn't want to run an organization in George Steinbrenner 1980s impulsivity. Knows it's going to scare away a lot of managers and potential front office types. But it sounded like in the few pieces of information that he gleaned, Mendoza was kind of not a fiery guy. Heard something through the baseball prospectus chat line over there that maybe he was bucking the front office and that pissed them off over the last few weeks. I didn't think Mendoza was a great manager. I didn't think he was a bad manager. I thought he was a typical 2026 extension of the front office where can you keep the media at bay? Can you manage a clean clubhouse? Can you manage up? And can you manage a bullpen? And he was, I didn't think he was terrible in game. I know some people disagree. I think there's so many things that go into in-game, especially when you're dealing with bullpens that are fluid, rest is always something that we're not always privy to. I know today there was a lot of people pissed off about Francisco Lindor getting a load management day. That's sports science in 2026. I mean, you just got to deal with it. The medical staff runs a lot of things now with the kind of world that we live in. But he was nondescript. And I think that's what we'll end up doing him in. And maybe Mendoza, similar to Luis Rojas, who's a coach with the Yankees now, they're better at being in the coaching staff and communicating and making an impact in that sense without being the top banana. Because being the top banana is, and they always say that, sliding over. What is the old saying? When you're an assistant coach, sliding over those 6 inches changes your world dramatically. But Andy Green, to me, he was honest. He was direct. There was no BS. I think that he gave you a little inkling into who he is. I thought he was a straight shooter, intelligent. He talked about getting respect and being adaptable with the players. And the biggest message he put in there is not something about effort and execution and preparation, which usually is what gets a manager fired. No, he didn't talk about that. He talked about cleaning up the vibe. He talked about to bring back that quote that Josh Hart talked about in the post game after the Knicks won a championship a couple of weeks ago, the weight of the uniform. And here's a guy that clearly, listening to him talk, enjoyed helping the prospects become big leaguers. He talked about it, enjoyed the process of helping these kids make it to the big leagues. He brought up Christian Scott and AJ Ewing and these guys that I think he's seen make their progression. And even though he's been in the front office, here's a guy that, as a 4A guy, knows how hard it is to be a big league ball player. Gave you some hope with the farm system that there's some arms at the upper level. The positional players, he was honest, a little bit further away. He believes in those arms, and that's a really good thing. That might be what ultimately saves Stern's job if they pan out. And he talked about the linear path to becoming a big leaguer that's filled with a lot of peaks and valleys and how you're going to learn a player's through adversity. So all he can do now, in really what I think he's there for, and I said that because he was honest, like, hey, I'm not taking this job full time. Even if I bring this team to the playoffs, unlikely. And I become the best manager that anyone's seen since Davey Johnson or Bobby V or whatever you want to call it. I want to spend time with my family. I want the flexibility that a front office job provides. And the way he lit up and talked about player development, I think that you could tell that that's where his passion is. And listening to him talk, you could see how hard a big league managerial job is. Not just what it does to your family life, but to actually be successful, do it well, and have any kind of longevity. Because we're in an environment, especially with social media and with the amount of money that it costs to field any kind of ball club, patience is not something that anybody in charge who owns a team, with the heat that comes down on a GM, an owner, that you really have the luxury for right now. So I think the one thing that Andy Green talked about that we've been talking about for a while, which we thought was eradicated after the OMG summer, and it looked like it was the first half of 2025, but it came back, is this weight of the Mets history that has, I've called it the yoke around their neck, that seems to always rear its head when things go bad, because things tend to crop back up. I mean, even this weekend with the Mr. Met dancing behind Gelb's and all the articles, oh, this is so Mets, like, who cares? Some goofball in marketing that did it. It's not like Steve Cohen has to, you know, do you have to send out a directive to every person in the entire organization from the parking attendant all the way on up? Well, these are things that we can't do because LOL Mets will come out. I mean, come on. Come on. So Andy Green's going to be here to clean up and see what's going on. And I think mainly Andy Green's going to be here as the head of player development to see what the hell he's got. And you saw again today that the biggest issue of the Mets and why the Mets are in the position they're at, and if it's Stearns' fault, it's Stearns' fault for believing in these guys that he inherited, is that Brett Beatty, Mark Vientos, Ronnie Mauricio, and Francisco Alvarez are borderlining on some of them being busts, at best case scenario, flawed big leaguers. A prospect group, and let me bring this up because I think this was important. I saw this on Twitter, and let me give proper credit where credit is due. I think they blast, yeah. So Rich McLeod, Rich, I think, does some stuff at a site called Just Mets. Rich McLeod listed the Mets' top 10 prospects from 2023. Post-100-win season, Billy Epler's in charge, Buck's still around. Alvarez was the number one prospect. Beatty was the number one, two prospect. Kevin Parada was the number three prospect. Alex Ramirez was the number four prospect. Jet Williams, the number five prospect. Ronnie Mauricio is the number six prospect. Blade Tidwell is the number seven prospect. Mark Vientos is the eighth prospect. Dominic Hamill is the ninth prospect. Calvin Ziegler, who's still in single A, 10th prospect. Not much there. Now, I know the guys they've traded, like Tidwell, and I think Hamill's out, but Tidwell is actually doing kind of well in a small sample size as a reliever. So, but still, he's pitched, what, 12 innings this year? So, not much there. Jet Williams, still to be determined, was part of the Freddie Peralta trade. Alex Ramirez is out of the system. Kevin Parada is starting to hit a little bit in AAA. Maybe he's a late bloomer. But the two, and I'll put even Mauricio aside, the two that you really needed to pan out in some way, and I'm not saying they had to be Hall of Famers, but really good contributing members, at least the component really good members of the lineup, were Alvarez and Beatty, and they just haven't been. And that's a killer. I mean, you have a top 10 list from just 3 years ago that you're getting nothing out of. I mean, maybe you could say Alvarez and Beatty are on the roster and starting, but they're giving you nothing. And in a big spot, and we've talked about this, Alvarez continues to be a guy that he just very anxious guy at the plate, doesn't have any kind of discipline. There's not a lot baseball-wise going between the ears. There's just not. I mean, he might work hard. He's got a great arm. He's got prodigious power, which we very rarely see anymore. I mean, the power that he displayed on his when he first came up, don't really see very much of it. Maybe part of that is the injuries to the hand and the hammett, and that could be, I mean, these are things that eventually sap your power, but that's where it's at. So Andy Green's going to be here to see what's going on. I mean, there's a lot of positives with Carson Benge and A.J. Ewing, and I still believe in Christian Scott and Nolan McLean, and we'll see. I thought Zach Thornton did an outstanding job on Friday with just locating. We wrote about him over at Extra Innings, the Beyond the Mic Substack, that I hope you're a subscriber to. If not, contact me. We got some 4th of July coupons. I'll give you a free trial. Just contact me at Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And, you know, that's where you're at. You know, he's going to be there to see if there's anything down there, because now you're at a critical moment. And I'll tell you why. David Stearns has 24 months. His contract is up. So all this about firing David Stearns, all this about, you know, protest and signage and we're going to go on, you know, Mike Francesa is going to get pressure on Steve Cohen to fire him, and we're just going to have Michael Kay yell and scream, and some idiot on the morning show at WFAN, and Craig Carton this. We're just going to yell and scream until he needs to be held accountable. I love this. He didn't show, there's a half of them that say, well, good job, he came out and showed accountability by having a press conference. He does a press conference every homestand. It's just in the dugout. And, oh, Cohen needs to come out and show accountability. What do you want him to say? He needs to fix this. What is he going to do? He's going to import 9 All-Stars tomorrow? So we're going to yell and scream. But the guy's got 24 months. And the reason you're in that situation, the reason that top 10 is a problem, the reason that Pete Crow Armstrong, who I still think is a streak player, I'm not saying that trade and everything, I don't think he's going to be as good as everyone thinks. Great fielder. I think hitting is going to be up and down. But maybe he's figuring it out. The reason he's in a Chicago Cubs uniform, the reason that you don't have, or you've just developed over the last 24 months, a philosophy inside the organization is because you've had time and time, and I got to scream it this time, because maybe if I'm screaming it, it's the first time you're hearing it, is that you've had tremendous turnover in this organization for 10 years. And now you, it's not maybe you listening, but a group of you, a good chunk of you, want to make it another turnover. I don't know, and I don't even know where you'd start. I got a friend of mine says, well, let's go get Theo Epstein. You think Theo Epstein wants this? He's rich. He's already broken two curses. He's got a pristine reputation. I think he's got ownership in a football, a soccer team, or you want to call it a football team. I don't know. He wants to come here so he can listen to some jughead in 12 months when things don't go well, scream and yell at him at Citi Field. Are you kidding me? When I could be enjoying my money to come here and help this group, this fan base that spent the summer of 2022 following Frank the Tank and the Barstool idiots and scream and yell at every two-game losing streak and blame the Mets for collapsing when the team behind them played like the 98 Yankees. Oh, because 101 wins, you choke. Ask the 1993 Giants how that is. Know how hard it is. How many teams are going to win 101 games this year? Not many. So you're stuck with Stearns for 2 years because it has to work out, because he's making $10 million a year, and you need to see this through. When he was hired, Cohen made the commitment that he was going to give him 5 years. You couldn't do anything less. Mendoza, he was on the last year of his contract. He wasn't even making a lot of money for a manager. What did he make, about $1 million? Managers in this day and age are fungible. It's not the NFL. It's not the NBA. They're not making $15 million a year. Craig Counsell, I think, is the exception. Baseball doesn't even want to pay the players. You think they want to start getting managers, getting big money? You think they want to start to see Craig Counsell become the norm? You think they want to have what Steve Kerr makes in the NBA? Go look at some NBA coaches, Sarge. Look at the NFL coaches. The NFL, the NBA, which is why those are attractive sports, I think, it's still a player-coaches league. It's not a front office league. Baseball's a front office league. That's the problem, the front office league. And the front office guy you got in charge is in charge of everything. He's the president of baseball operations, not a GM. Now, you want to argue that Cohen sits and say, hey, buddy, you got to get yourself a baseball person. And I actually got a really interesting email over at the website. And somebody said that I should bring this up, and it was brilliant. And if you're listening, I want to thank you. And I think this has been talked about a little bit with the Shermans and the Harpers of the world about how, you know, maybe Stearns doesn't have a group of diverse opinions or thoughts, or maybe there's too much analytical groupthink in the front office. There's not a Brian Sabian or Omar Minaya or an old school guy. You know, everybody loves to talk about Buster Posey, former player in San Francisco, who gets criticized too. There's not enough of the player touch and feel inside the organization. Now, I don't know if that's 100% true because you've got J.D. Martinez and Carlos Beltran in that front office. And I have a hard time believing two guys, and I know J.D. Martinez might be a little bit more advanced in the analytics because that saved his career, but with Carlos Beltran in that front office, a guy that started playing in the 90s, I have a hard time believing that that's not the case. Now, are they getting the seat at the table, and are they listened to as much? Who knows? But the crossroads is now here. And David Stearns is in a position where he's got 24 months. He'll be, if this doesn't get better, and if 2 years from now, we're still talking about the same garbage with the farm system and the team being in this, you know, really bad position in the standings or malaise, then yeah, he's not going to get his contract renewed. And maybe he gets fired before the season is out so they could start rebuilding. So at this time, 2 years from now, June, July, I could see him, if we're in the same spot, talking about the same things, I could see David Stearns getting fired. I absolutely do. And then we'll see. Now, I know what the fan, and you know, some of the fans, oh, why would you wait that long? It's two more years. You got to play it out. You don't know if Andy Green believes as much in the player development that he's talking about, that the processes and the technology and the infrastructure, that a lot of it is not overt, being put in place is helping, then, you know, you got to play it out. You got to play it out. There's nothing else you can do at this point. You can't do, and I keep reading it, it's the same thing. Sandy Olsen gets sick. You have three GMs in Omar and Ricciardi and Rico. Then Brody Van Wagenen comes in. Then Cohen takes over and Alderson comes back in. And Jared Porter's there for a hot minute and he's fired. And then Alderson steps in and Zach Scott is hired. And Billy Epler this. And now Stearns, like, it's too much in 10 years. And all, I think there's been five or six player development guys. I think there was five of them before Andy Green took over. all the different philosophies. The reason Pete Carmstrong, and I doubt Pete Carmstrong gets traded if Stearns is in charge in 2021, is in Chicago because you had a guy that was trying to win. And I think, and I've been as big of a culprit on this as anybody else. I really have. I believe when Cohen came in, unlike what the Orioles have done and Chicago and Houston, I didn't think you were in a position with all the pain the fans have been through, with all the situation you still had, you had that World Series in 2015 and you had those pitchers that you didn't leverage. I thought with his money, you could rebuild and win at the same time. And he spent a ton of money trying to do it. A ton of money. And he came close. Look, give him credit. 100-win season. Lost in the first round of the playoffs. A run to the NLCS. So it hasn't been a complete zero. But there's been these valleys that I know have drove Mets fans nuts. 2023, this year, and then the second half of last year. And the fact that a year ago, and this is the thing that drives me nuts, where there's so much impatience here. A year ago, when this downturn started, nobody talked about firing David Stearns in June of 2025. Nobody. The Mets had the best record in the sport over a 12-month period. But here's where it's interesting, and here's where it could get dangerous. I saw this on the internet. The last two stretches that the Mets have had similar to this over a two-year period was 2003 to 2004, the end of the Bobby Valentine, Steve Phillips era, in between that and the Omar Minaya era, and 2017 to 2018 when Sandy Alderson got sick, and that's when the chaos kind of started leading into Cohen. And to be truthful, the chaos has been quelled, but it hasn't really completely been snuffed. Both of those periods led to a historic, dramatic response. 2003 to 2004, and I think the culmination, and this is the cries and the anger right now, are very similar to the summer of 04 after they traded Scott Kazmir. And Omar Minaya came in, and then you had the Los Mets and Pedro Martinez and Carlos Baerga, Carlos Delgado, Carlos Beltran, Wright Reyes kind of were there. And look, there ain't no Wright or Reyes coming up from the minors right now. See, that's a big difference. Yeah, those two guys that kind of were the beginning of that next foundation, and the Mets went out and splashed on all those free agents. So you had that response, and that worked for a few years. And then Madoff played a little bit into why after that there was that purgatory. And then 27 to 2018 led to Brody Van Wagenen, led to the Jared Kelnick trade, led to him trying to go all in to win, not selling off Wheeler. And then obviously when it didn't work out in 2019, they were kind of, you know, trying to plug things with the COVID year, plug things, and then that led to Cohen. So you didn't really see how that would go, but they hired an agent, which was very radical at the time. So now you're at the same period. You read what I said that Salmon wrote. Well, Salmon says, well, Cohen doesn't want to be impulsive. Well, that means that Stearns is going to get the job, because if you fire Stearns now, there's going to be a lot of executives. Anybody who's really good is going to say, no thanks. Now, an up-and-comer, sure, they may take the job. What makes you think they're going to be any better? Well, they're different. They're not Stearns. Well, let's go old school. The old school guys are gone. They're never coming back. Never. It's over. The game's passed them by. It's over. Capital O. Sandy Alderson not coming in another time. He was antiquated pretty much halfway through his first tenure. Never mind now. So that's the question. Is now Cohen going to start being meddlesome? And, you know, the question even is, was he driving force behind getting Mendoza out? Because Stearnsby has been viewed as someone patient. Now, I've read all sorts of things that Cohen's wife, Alex, really liked Carlos, that Stearns was upset because Mendoza stopped following the front office script. These are all unverified rumors. These are all from those baseball perspectives chats that I get thrown at me with the Jared Sadlers of the world and what have you. How true it is, where their sources are, how up the food chain, down the food chain, and how the telephone game of rumor mill, I don't know. It's out there. I tell you that, and I tell you it's unverified. Take it as you will. take it as you will. But you have 24 months of David Stearns to figure this out. And in the middle, this is how hard this is. In the middle of this is the labor and the CBA and a battle, because you have the owners wanting to turn the sport economically into the NBA and the NFL. And the players saying, no, we're the most powerful union in the history of sports unions. We want to keep it the same. And similar to like a political rally, you know, the owners are cute. And here's where I really can't take sides on everything. I like to really be down the middle. But this whole like saving competitive balance sounds like a BS political slogan. It's kind of like when people say they're saving democracy. Anytime they make it, now everything is, I'm saving democracy. It doesn't matter what your position is, I'm saving democracy. Well, competitive balance is the saving democracy of baseball. Doesn't matter. I'm not making a partisan statement, by the way. You know, hear everybody talk about democracy. It doesn't matter which party. Sometimes they say things like, well, what does that have to do with democracy? You know, really, it doesn't have anything to do with it. What does that have to do with competitive balance? Last I looked, I see a pretty damn competitive balance league. See a lot. I mean, there's like four teams in the American League that are over 500. But you're at a really interesting road. Does Cohen go out and say, we're going to get Alex Cora because he's got to sell hope to the fans? Or we're going to go out there and make a big trade to bring in Mike Trout because he's got to show the fans that he cares? I mean, the poor guy tries to tweet and get on Twitter and they're using anti-Semitic commentary to him. Like, why? Like, it's not that serious. Like, I love sports. I love the Mets. I love the Knicks. I am still on cloud nine about the Knicks championship. I'm stressed as hell about free agency because I think that they're not going to lose some key members. And the Knicks are 2 weeks from a championship. I cannot wait for the Mets to achieve what the Knicks have done the last 12 months. But I'm not going to go and curse out the owner. He's not purposely trying to harm your product. You know, everybody's like, you don't care. Like, they care. You think he likes losing $200 million a year? Really? So, the last couple of times the Mets have been in this spot, the noise got loud. The noise got loud in 2004. The noise got loud in 17 and 18. Mets made some bold moves. One worked out with Omar Minaya and Los Mets. The other gave you a few good months in the summer. And truthfully, I'll tell you what, 2024, Stearns' first year, and I saw someone tweet about this, and I actually believe that might be accurate, might have been the worst thing that happened to this franchise because it gave the fans a feeling that this organization was in a better spot than it was. They had some veterans that were performing together, some J.D. Martinez, Iglesias giving the last vestiges of their baseball lives. You had a decent, not good, not great, decent, very good core of offensive players, some hot pitchers, an elite closer, and you barely got to the NLCS. It took a couple of home runs to get you there. It took two ninth inning home runs to get you there. So Lindor doesn't have a home run or Pete doesn't have a home run. I think your whole feeling on that season is different. And I think your feelings about Pete Alonso are a hell of a lot different because I got to tell you, I have never seen a player and I saw Strawberry leave. The fans loved Reyes and I saw him leave. Piazza left. We could probably find some others. I wasn't around for Seaver, but I mean, people are acting this generation like Tom Seaver walked out the door. He's a 3,500 RBI power hitting first baseman. Really good player. Love Pete. Go down as a really good Met. I don't even know if he'll be in the Mets Hall of Fame. I don't think his number will be retired. And the fans are acting like Mickey Mantle walked out the door. I mean, Albert Pujols left St. Louis. There's an all-time Hall of Famer. And I don't think Cardinals fans acted the same way. But that's a separate thing. So my feeling is I'm afraid that Cohen is going to make an impulsive move. On the field, managerial, start to neuter Stearns, and then at that point, you basically have another carbon copy of the Wilpons, Whitmoney, or George Steinbrenner in the 1980s. And that would be a bad thing. So when we come back, a lot of mailbag, a lot of commentary from you. We'll get to that, and we'll see what you have to think about this. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. Mailbag and some commentary. And what's interesting, as I was in the break, I noticed that Eric Chavez, former Mets hitting coach, bench coach, has had a lot to say. Not a big David Stearns guy, is out on his podcast, EC the Three Pod. And I'll play you actually one of the snippets. I see some of them walking around, you know, making their way around Twitter, X, like, you know, who the hell knows what to call it. This was interesting. Let me play this now. This is Eric Chavez talking about a phone call with David Stearns. Take a listen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And when you get let go,
yeah,
it's the perfect encapsulation of all the stuff that you just talked about.
Yeah, in which I, like I said, I knew this was coming. I knew changes were coming. I didn't know the whole staff was going to be let go. Yeah, and he calls me. And I said, hey, David, what's up? And we talked about this, I think, before, too. And he goes, you know, not having a good day. I said, okay, what's up, dude? He goes, well, we're going to go in a different direction. And I go, okay. And he goes, and he hangs up the phone, right? And I'm thinking to myself, like, man, like there's no, you know, thanks for what you did. Thanks for the hard work. Like, and coaches, man, that are, they put in the hours. Like, as a coach, I'd never been so exhausted in my life those 4 years I was coaching. Yeah. And just kind of the lack of personal connect, gratitude, appreciation. For me, it's just, you know, well, we're just going to move on, and it is what it is. And, you know, that was the four strike for me, you know, of like, this isn't the dude. This isn't the right guy. I don't know where it came from. I don't know who built him up. You know, I heard a reporter ask him yesterday, have you thought about stepping down? And he gave his smirk, and he's like, no. And it's like, well, he stepped down before. He stepped down in Milwaukee. I don't know.
So you listen to that, and there's a lot more. He talks about Juan Soto. He tells a story about Juan Soto after his at-bats going in the clubhouse and an assistant GM kind of, you know, coddling him, looking at his at-bats. I mean, Juan Soto's a, you know, cage rat. And I guess he complained about it to Stearns, saying this is not good. He should be in the dugout with his teammates. He's setting the bad example to the young players. And Stearns said to Chavez, hey, you know, they need to understand they're not Juan Soto. And to a certain degree, I understand what Chavez is saying. You know, Juan Soto, as the best player, highest paid player on the team, worried about his at-bats, worried about his hitting, may not sit well when you're trying to win some ball games. I don't know if that bothers me so much. I know that, you know, that was a big deal back in the 80s with Greg Jeffries. I know players are going to, you know, fans are going to talk about being a team. And I think baseball is such an individualistic sport. Everybody has their process that, you know, I don't know if that bothers me. I do think there's a line to be drawn there, but this isn't like beer league softball on a Sunday. We get together and we're going to stick together and things like that. I think if Juan Soto has 45 home runs and 100 plus RBIs, the whole going into the locker room in between at bats isn't going to bother people so much. And I generally think he does interact with his teammates, and I think that it could also have been, like I talked about, the pressure of signing that contract and moving across town. But Eric Chavez had a lot to say. You heard one snippet there. I think the thing that came out of, and the reason I picked that phone call, Chavez phone call when he got fired, it was kind of a, it's so on brand for Moneyball. Remember when Brad Pitt played Billy Bean and they traded Jeremy Giambi, and he told Jonah Hill, who was Paul D. Podesta, how basically, you know, hey, go in and just say, hey, you know, here's your walking papers. We traded you to Philadelphia. Thank you for your service. Goodbye. Same thing with Carlos Pena. And it's very much on brand with that. Is there a human touch lacking with Stearns? I could see that. He's very corporate in his interaction with the media. I felt he was more relaxed earlier in his tenure. I always feel he gives you a little bit to chew on, but you got to read through the lines. He doesn't really lie to you. Now I think he's pulled back. And, you know, maybe there's a certain level, and you go back to the Alonso, the Nimmo, and moving all these guys. And the Mets are in such a tough spot, because when you're trying to manage a payroll, when you're trying to build a team, and when you're trying to implement a philosophy, there's that, and any GM, president of baseball operations, will say that you got to be emotionless. You can't get attached to these players. And maybe Stearns has gone to the other extreme. Chavez is an old school baseball guy. He's a Stearns critic. You're going to get everything anti-Stearns with Chavez. But I think it's important to put it out there. I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle here. And some interesting things to be said about Chavez. I don't think that they're clear-cut negatives on what he said about Soto, what he said about Stearns. I think it's a situation where maybe Juan Soto, on the Soto part, you need to have certain types of yin and yang with Soto in a locker room. You know, Soto was not imported to be a leader, a rah-rah leader. He was imported because he's an elite, top-five run creator in the sport. You got to get, and maybe that's part of the thing. You know, you have Lindor and Soto. Lindor is a gregarious, you know, more affable guy, a talkative guy. You got a lot of young players. Pete was an emotional guy. Nimmo was a gamer, maybe a bit of a clubhouse politician, a gamer. McNeil was a gamer, a dirtball type of player. When you had the Harrison Baders and the J.D. Martinez's and Iglesias, a guy like that, you had those kind of veterans in the locker room. And those are guys that are important. And you can't ask Soto to be those guys because that's not who he is. And then as far as the personal touch with Stearns, I mean, you're hearing from Chavez the way he kind of did a Brad Pitt and Moneyball and fired him on the phone. Maybe he's not exactly, you know, the warmest guy. He's not trying to do any kind of sales pitch. Like me, when I deliver bad news, I'm direct. I'm very similar to Stearns, but I also try to walk away with the person at least feeling valuable. And that's more from a business perspective, and I think you'd want to do that. And I think that's what Chavez was alluding to here. But anyway, this came down during the break. I played you a snippet. EC to the three. I'm sure we'll talk more about it. All right, let's get to some mailbag here. And Barry over in the chat room, and I think that this kind of ties in to maybe what Chavez was saying. Barry's rant, stupid baseball management by analytics. Scott is at 82 pitches, about to face the top of the order for a third time. Two on, one out. So instead of allowing him to face the top of the order to learn how to face guys a third time, they take him out after four and a third innings and go burn the bullpen. Like the Mets are going to make the playoffs, ? Let the kids learn how to pitch by letting him face Turner and Schwarber a third time. The front office does not understand how to develop humans, only build spreadsheets. Now, Barry, this ties into what Chavez just said. And I am the biggest guy when it comes to push starters, got to get more seven innings out of starters, got to be a way to develop starters to go 180 to 200 innings. I'm not asking for 230 to 250 plus anymore. I'm not asking for that. Give me 180 to 200. Give me guys that go 175, 180 innings, six plus. Get it to the point where it's only nine outs in a bullpen. You got to get it. Can't get, seven to nine outs. It can't be 12 to 15 every night. It's got the Mets in trouble. Now, with that said, Scott coming back from his hip issue, being a young pitcher, first year off of Tommy John, I think that it might play into where I might give them a bit of a pass on this. You know, this is very similar to the debate that goes on in the NBA with load management. And, the Knicks are not a load. They were never under Thibodeau a load management team. They're a little bit more of a load management team under Mike Brown. Mitchell Robinson's a perfect example, but he's an extreme. But you have either the guys, like Josh Hart and some of these other guys, Carl Anthony Towns, they're given a reasonable amount of days off, which probably cost the Knicks during the season about five wins and maybe home court advantage if they had, wound up facing the Pistons. They wound up not mattering in the Eastern Conference. It mattered in the finals. But anyway, sports science, and I said this earlier, is kind of starting to run the show because you have these assets out there that are a lot of money. And let's also remember, and this goes back to what I said at the beginning, Stearns has got 24 months. And if this goes bad for Stearns, this Mets tenure, it's not like he's going to have a lot of jobs lined up for him in baseball. Now, he's made, if he runs the contract out, he's made $50 million. He's wealthy, and I'm sure he'll do okay, and he'll wind up being like Zach Scott. He'll start some kind of consulting firm or do something else in business and maybe his other interests. He's Ivy League educated. He ain't going to starve. And maybe he gets a job doing something or running something on, Paul DePodesta was a GM for the Dodgers. He came back and he's done okay for himself in two sports. He's back running the Rockies. So, you know, maybe that's part of it. So I understand, Barry, what you're saying. I think the sport needs to get more towards that, because what I see, and what I see even the Mets doing, is being much more comfortable with relievers going early in the game, starters going bulk in the middle, kind of building the game backwards. And, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. You saw that, you know, when Peterson was here, Senga did it today, and what have you. And I just think you got to go back to the traditional route, get guys back to seven innings. You just got to. I mean, that's just my take. By the way, and I wrote about this over at Beyond the Mic this week, over at Extra Innings, Extra Innings Series. I think Senga's Mets career, now he pitched pretty well. I know he gave the home run to Schwarber. He pitched five innings, but he was throwing some heat out of the bullpen today. And I believe, and the only thing that's stopping this from happening is, I don't know if he can, on a dime, get the call and basically get up ready in 20 to 25 pitches and come into a spot. So him as a bullpen arm might be a little restrictive, where you have to plan him out. I don't know if he could go 3 out of 5 days out of the pen, even if he pitched just an inning. He might be a guy that you might be only pitching an inning. I don't know. Or he might be a guy like how Seth Lugo was when he went from starter to bullpen before he became a starter again, where once you got him in a game, you had to run him three innings because he was going to be down the next day. He could not get back up back-to-back days. Now, it got better as time went on, but Seth Lugo was always a guy you got to be careful about his recovery time, because he had that tendon, and he's never had to get Tommy John. I think he had a torn tendon in his arm at one point. And I also know that there was always, you know, different type of lat issues I thought he had at one point. I know that that was part of it. So I think Senga at the bullpen, and I compared him, and if you're a subscriber, go read it. I compared him to another Japanese pitcher, Koji Uehara, who made the transition from a starter to a very elite bullpen arm and helped the Red Sox win the 2013 World Series coming out of the bullpen as their closer. Now, I don't know if Senga could be the closer, but to me, you have 2 more years left on that deal. And, you know, this year, next year, and, you know, to me, you got to just, let me make sure I got that right. I think Senga's got another year on his deal after this year. I think this year, next year, right? Let's see. Just to make sure I give you the right information here. Salaries. Where's Senga's salary? Hold on. Salary, Senga. Of course, when you need it, it's never here. I'm pretty sure he had a 5-year deal. And he's actually got 2 more years, 27, and then there's the team option. So there's the team option. They could get out of that. But it's conditional option if Senga's placed the IL for at least 130 consecutive days for the right elbow. So he's got 1 more year. You owe him $15 million. Why not turn him to a useful piece out of the bullpen? If he can do it. We'll see. It still sounded like, listening to postgame, that he was looking to get back in the rotation. I'm not surprised at that. So, all right, let's get to the mailbag. What do we got here? Let's see what we got. Oh, boy. All right. Ben writes, Mendoza. I'm writing to share my thoughts following the news of Mendoza's departure. While he seems like a good person, I believe moving on was a necessary step, as his in-game management has been underwhelming throughout his 3 seasons. He's a below-average manager who was a lame duck. As I mentioned in my emails dating back to 2024, I haven't seen the growth I hoped for after his rookie year. This season in particular, the team looked sloppy, and his lack of confidence was apparent when he talked. He had dead man walking energy. Furthermore, I feel the media coverage has been poor, often over-defending Mendoza due to his accessibility while unfairly criticizing Stearns. Mendoza texts with the media and Stearns doesn't. That's what this is about. The sappy selfie videos and media gelbs Cone put out acting like Mendoza passed away. Enough already. The recent sentimental reactions from the press and the focus on trivial details like writing an article and Stearns not wearing a quarter zip highlight this disconnect. Looking ahead, I believe the best course of action for the remainder of the season is to prioritize playing the younger players. I also suggest selling available assets to help bolster and bring reinforcements to the farm system. So, look, Ben, I agree with you. I thought the media coverage on Friday was pretty bad. I did see that article about, or that, even a tweet about what Stearns was wearing. You know, he had the jacket instead of the quarter zip. I mean, Cole Mathis, who they acquired for Peterson, I wrote about him, is an interesting bat. It doesn't look like he's played any for the Mets yet, But in high A, and between high A and A this year, he's got an OPS of just under 1,000. He's got 10 home runs, 39 RBIs. Seems to be an on-base guy. Has been throughout his career a converted pitcher. So he's a he's a righty bat, corner first baseman. We'll see. We'll see what comes out of it here. I mean, it's a positional need. The Mets are going to need. And you heard, you saw our good friend contributor, David Mills, who sounds like you guys want more. Maybe we got to get David on sometime after the 4th of July. And start to get him in. I know you guys. I saw some of the comments there. We'll get David on there, and we'll see. So, as far as Mendoza, can't disagree there. I am a guy that would like a manager to have some character and autonomy in the dugout. With obviously getting information from the front office, and I don't know how a front office who provides information but then doesn't see all of it implemented, what a manager is going to, how they're going to handle that. Now, Andy Green is clearly an extension of the front office, and I think his managing is not completely going to be as, even if he wanted to be autonomous, I think the way he's going to manage the rest of the season is protecting the young players, protecting any of the assets of young players. So you may see pitchers like with Christian Scott get pulled a little sooner, whereas if it was in a win situation, you might see them push him a little bit more. The Mets have to really identify over the next 3 months some core players that they can move forward with. Because I don't believe they're going to trade Lindor. They can't really trade Soto. I don't think they could trade Lindor. You got two, hopefully they still have some. I mean, Soto clearly has run away as a top 10 player in the sport. Lindor, you could start to see some decline, we'll see. But then you go around the diamond, you've got A.J. Ewing and bench, so that's a positive. I'm not so sure where Alvarez fits into this. I think our friend David Mills over at Extra Innings, the Beyond the Mic Substack, suggested looking to see if maybe the Mets should trade him. I think Bo Bichette will be back. I don't think he's going to opt out unless he really hates it here. And then after that, you have your McLean, your Scott. And then, the kids in the minors, the Thorntons, the Weningers, the Tongs, guys like that. Those are your keepers. I mean, I'm not going to count any of the bullpen guys because I know Luke Weaver's having a great year and Brazenbaum is having a great year. But those are relievers. That's a different situation. So I'm not so much worried about that. This is about Benj, Ewing, McLean, Scott, Soto, Lindor, and maybe Alvarez. I think Alvarez, to me, is going to be one of the more interesting. Because I think the Beatty, I'm pretty much written off. Vientos, I'm done with. I don't think Mauricio knows how to play. I've told you that for a while. That's how I feel there. Let's see what else we got here. What do we got here? Sam. Another day in Metsland. Well, the growing hostility toward David Stearns in New York. There's a growing hostility toward David Stearns in New York. My takeaway is that he's become one of the most polarizing figures in the city right now. Even though I know you don't usually follow the local radio personalities, the rhetoric has been incredibly harsh. I do look at clips, Sam, and I do know it's getting harsh. I saw some of what Francesa has said as well. With Brandon Tierney calling him a fraud, Roberts calling him a clueless geek, and Francisco calling him a spineless idiot. I've seen a lot of that. Tierney is a Yankee fan, and Francesco is a blowhard trying to get relevancy from the grave, and Roberts, I think, is trying to be cool with the Mets fans. But look, I wouldn't go any of those. I wouldn't call the guy names. The most I'd say is I think Stearns might have to have some, and I think it goes back to that email I got on the website. He might need to have a more diversified cabinet. Is he listening to some experienced baseball people? He may need like Cashman, a Manaya, or a Brian Sabin, or a guy like that in his cabinet. And maybe Beltran and J.D. Martinez are not enough. While I don't believe he's done a great job as president so far, those labels seem extreme. However, things feel like they are reaching a breaking point. I noticed Stearns looked a bit rattled during his press conference, which is a departure from his usual calm and collected demeanor. I agree there. I mentioned that earlier. There is clearly no love lost between him and the Mets beat writers, and even snapped during his media availability regarding the coaching staff's preparation. I hope Steve Cohen stays measured and doesn't give in to the mob that is calling for Stearns' head. That said, I think it would be wise to bring in a fresh outside voice as general manager under David to help steer the ship. I think that'll be the interesting thing. Can they bring somebody in? And will that person be maybe a bit of a different mind to David. And can David handle that? Can he handle somebody who's different than him? I mean, having different personalities, it's not easy when you have two different types of personalities. Believe me, I personally have that experience in business where you have my personality and how I look at things, and then someone who's very measured and analytical and strategic. Not easy. Trust me, not easy. On the other hand, the public perception of Mendoza is confusing to me. Some are treating him like Connie Mack, but I don't see him as a leader or a strong tactician. In my view, the clubhouse hasn't had real leadership since Jose Iglesias and JD were there. Listening to Andy Green recently, he seems to have more presence than Carlos ever did. Totally agree with all of that. I've seen your tweets, and they are funny. But with the team 13 games below 500 and carrying the second highest payroll, we have to acknowledge the last two seasons have been an absolute embarrassment. I mean, look, the Twitter thing people take too seriously. I like to bust the fans' chops. And I don't like some of the discourse on Twitter. I should probably stay out of it, but Mets fans drive me nuts. And and part of me, like when people say things, okay, back it up with facts, and they usually don't have it. But you're right; I should probably stay out of the fray on Twitter. Twitter gets everybody in trouble. So, all right. What do we got here? Andy, hardships. Not to sound insensitive, I feel like the Mendoza firing is nothing burger. I never sensed he was a difference maker or a culture changer. He seemed like a boring communicator who didn't bring much energy. I honestly don't think he gets another managing job, similar to how things have gone for Luis Rojas. Looking ahead, I'm curious what happens to guys like Willard, Albert, Snitker after this season if Stern still wants to keep them for the next manager. Regarding the roster, I think fans need to stop focusing on Nimmo and Alonso. There aren't difference makers anymore, which is why they were moved on from. Looking at the 2024 roster, it wouldn't be a good team in 26. In fact, I feel like 24 was the worst thing to happen to the organization. On the pitching side, I was interested to see Thornton's next start before he was sent down. And now that Peterson has been traded, I'm reflecting on his strange, inconsistent tenure. It makes me wonder who was the better Met, Peterson or Matz. Also, at the plate, I currently feel more confident in Young and Wagamon than in Beatty and Vientos. That's probably a bad thing. There's a lot in this email, Andy. This is a chock full of stuff, though. And we're going to, by the way, this will be the capper on the mailbag, because Andy's giving me a ton of stuff to go over. If I could offer one piece of constructive criticism, it would be perhaps to be a bit less defensive of Stearns and Cohen. They are currently two games away from having the worst record in baseball, following a season with the worst second-half record. It's been a bad year for the farm system as well, and I believe they should be more highly criticized by the masses. They have failed. It's frustrating to see how the Brewers don't seem to miss a beat every single season by comparison. Lastly, on the basketball side, it's disappointing to see Dolan return to his old ways, overruling the front office regarding the apron to run the Knicks championship team back. At least we can say Cohen isn't him. Well, just to end with Dolan, we'll see what happens, Andy. I'm disappointed in the second apron. It isn't an easy conversation. And signing Mitchell Robinson and Shamet, although on a basketball side, if this is baseball where you don't have it's just the luxury tax and you don't have the second apron restrictions, it's a no-brainer. I think Mitchell Robinson does come with some risk because of his health, and I think sometimes he gives off, especially with the broken hand, some goofy vibes on the personal side. I had a chance to meet Shamet last week on Long Island. I went to an event at a bar near me in Smithtown, and he was a gentleman. He was a great guy. I got a chance to take a couple pictures with him, and I listened to his, and if you're a basketball fan, I know I'm probably boring some baseball fans, but if you're a basketball fan, there's a podcast called The Old Man in the Three, and Shamet's on there with John Turturro, the actor John Turturro, because they think he's his doppelganger. And it was a great podcast. Really erudite on basketball, on life, on acting. Like, it's interesting. You should check it out. Even if you're not a huge, even if you're just a casual basketball fan, check it out. But as far as Mendoza, the vibe I get from a lot of Mets fans is, Andy, you're right. Mendoza to me was nondescript. He didn't bother me. He didn't excite me. He was an extension of the front office. And I said, if the team is good and built properly, there's not a heck of a lot he could do to screw it up. And I do feel he's a bit of a sacrificial lamb. I think because he was not an impactful guy or a personable guy, and maybe if the Baseball Prospectus guys are right, or with the Baseball America or I don't know who Seidler works for, maybe Baseball America guys, I should say. Maybe if they're right, maybe he started bucking the front office. That's certainly going to be where you fire a guy. There was some vibe from Salmon, one of other Salmon, Will Salmon's articles over at The Athletic, that maybe the clubhouse was starting to feel that he was dead man walking, or there was a lack of energy from him. Maybe he was too business-like, process-like. Hey, we're coming here, and this is, you know, we're. It's almost like the if he's a lame duck, you're like the substitute teacher in June when the kids know that school's being let out in a month. Like, are they really going to listen to you? You just got to get them to behave. There's no difference maker there. I don't know where they go for the next manager. I do think there's some interesting names out there. I thought Rob Thompson did a nice job with the Phillies for a while. He'll be out there. Obviously, Alex Cora. Albert Pujols seems to be pulling a Gary Carter here and petitioning for the job. Obviously, with the relationship with Soto, I wonder what Soto's influence will be on that. And it goes back to what I said in the beginning, that, you know, hopefully Cohen allows Stearns to cook if he's going to keep him as president. But then you listen to what Chavez said, and you wonder, you know, if Chavez is saying these things, and especially if Cohen is starting to, you know, he's going to obviously have access to this info, you know, how does that make him feel? You know, maybe Stearns as a president needs help. Maybe he needs another voice in there. And maybe he needs, and this is the biggest thing as a leader, can he handle diverse ideas in his cabinet? Can he handle, can a modern front office handle a manager that is autonomous thinking? You know, can you put the team together? Can you provide a blueprint of how you want things to go and provide information to the manager and then trust that that manager who you interviewed, who you hired, can execute it? And maybe, you know, and this is the big key, it's not just about them executing it from a standpoint of the tactics and running a clean clubhouse. Can they motivate and handle some of the difficult things, like what Chavez said about Soto in the clubhouse? You know, it seemed like Mendoza was kind of hands-off, or at least that's the way it made it seem. Now, I always used to say, because we don't know what Mendoza's doing and saying, there wasn't a lot of leaks. And I'm not so sure, Andy, that he's texting. And maybe it wasn't you that said it, but it was the comment that was made about the texting of with the media. I don't know if that was, we don't know if that was going on. I mean, the media probably has more interaction with Carlos, and Carlos is more affable off camera, where he's more likable. You know, Stearns comes across very corporate and dry, and the thing that drives the fans and the media nuts is Stearns doesn't care what they think. He's stubborn. He's going to do it his way. Now, that could be a bad trait when things are going wrong. You have to know when to pivot. You know, you have to be adaptable. I could understand that. I tend to be a stubborn guy, too, in my belief system. And if I believe it, I'm going to and I'm not running a baseball team, but that could, I've learned that sometimes you have to be different. You have to be open-minded. You have to look at how things have evolved, the game, the era of players, things like that. So, you know, that's part of it. I do agree, Andy. I think I said it earlier, and I even said this, I thought about this, and I talked about it before you even wrote this to me. 2024 is going to go down as a really fun, great year. And I think, you know, it'll go down for some fans who are younger as their favorite Mets moment. To me, my favorite Mets seasons are going to be 99, 2006, 2015. Like, those stand out to me. And, you know, 2000, maybe really 99, 2000, two-year period. And for some Mets fans, 24 was a great experience because they're not really old enough to remember 15, and they've seen a lot of not-so-great baseball in between. But it wasn't a perfect team. And then when you look, just 2 years later, Winker's out of the league. Iglesias is out of the league. You know, you look at the bullpen. It wasn't great even back then. The lineup lacked some length. Bader, you know, there's just guys who had really good seasons and got really hot for 6 months. It happens. So as far as the constructive criticism, look, I almost feel like I have to defend Stearns and Cohen because the masses are so much beating up on both of them. And I'm fearful that, you know, Cohen is going to buy in to talk radio and the fans. I hope he doesn't, because all the fans at talk radio will do will drag you from one side to the other. I always say this, the media and the fans are like the guy. I used to have a neighbor. The neighbor would be all passionate about something. Go, 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 go do this, go do this. And then you'd go do it and you turn around you and he'd go, oh, listen, tell me how it goes. I got to go inside my house. And you'll follow the fans and the media, And when it doesn't work out, they're like, that sucked. Oops. Because they really don't know. Because for them, it's about an agenda. The fans who are emotional because they're in love with their team, and the media who are just doing it to get a rise out of the fans because they got to get clicks at a story. You got to do what you think is right. You got to give Stearns, I say it again. Stearns has a contract for two more years till 2028. Next year is going to be a wonky year because of the CBA. June of 2028, 2 years from today, he could be on the hot seat and getting fired at that point. If we're talking about the same nonsense, two years, put it on your calendar, make a date. Hopefully, the world will still be around. If the world is still around, I'll be around. Make a date, June 28th, 2028. And I know you guys will hold me to it because I'll get emails on June 28th or that weekend. You know, you promised me 2 years ago you were going to talk about Stearns. So I don't think, and unless there's a scandal or there's something that we're not seeing, because you're blowing up the whole front office again. Unless you want to keep the front office and elevate a Beltran or a J.D. Martinez, or maybe he elevates somebody to be a real, I mean, he's got these assistant GMs. Does he elevate anybody? It's a big job. At this point, I don't know where to go. There's not big name GMs that have come in and have a track record of cleaning things up. And nobody's going to switch over. A successful person, there's no money Cohen could give them to lure Andrew Friedman from the Dodgers. Someone like that. Unless there's, and I'd have to go through the list, you're not going to do a lateral move. Stearns came over because you're president of baseball operations. It would have to be an assistant GM or a GM that wants out of his current situation, whose contract is up, because you can't just interview for a job for a lateral move. You have to compensate these guys. So that's it. I hope you enjoyed this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast as the summer has now kicked off. We have the 4th of July ahead of us, holiday weekend, and we're talking about a front office and firing managers and really about 2027. So the next month will be interesting with the trade deadline just 5 or 6 weeks away. We clearly don't have to talk about what this team needs because it doesn't matter. They're not going to bring in reinforcements. What it does need, it needs to beef up the farm system. And it started with the Peterson trade, bringing in a righty bat with some power. And let's see where the rest of it goes. And I wonder if there'll be a surprise or two in the next month. I really do. So we'll see. All right, that's it. Thanks for tuning in to the latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G. And on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.